Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, I've been waiting for this program for several weeks because it's a chance for you, for us to look behind the scenes and a chance for you to ask a question about how we produce news here at IPR and NPR. One of our guests is NPR's ombudsman and public editor, Elizabeth Jensen, joining us from NPR in Washington. Elizabeth, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much. My pleasure to be here.
Also joining Elizabeth and myself, Michael Leland is with us as well, IPR News Director and IPR Executive Director Myrna Johnson, both in our Des Moines studio. Myrna, Michael, welcome to you.
Hey, Ben.
Hi there.
We want to reach out to our listeners this hour. As I said, it's your chance to talk back to us this hour about how we serve you with the news and any questions you might have about the way we serve news and produce news. 1-866-780-9100, 1-866-780-9100, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org is our email. And there will be lots of questions. I'm quite sure we'll get to as many as we can during the hour, that I promise you. Elizabeth Jensen, start off by defining a little bit of your role as ombudsman and public editor at NPR, where your responsibility lies and where it doesn't, I suppose.
Sure. So the ombudsman, news ombudsman specifically, acts as a liaison between the public and the newsroom. So that's why many other news organizations, at least those that until recently have had ombudspeople, have started calling them public editors. Mm. It's a little bit of a misnomer because I don't have any editorial role in the newsroom itself. Again, my job is to be a liaison to make sure that listener concerns are heard in the newsroom, to relay, if you will, the newsroom's response to some of those concerns, to talk about areas where I think the journalism could be even stronger, to investigate corrections, investigate how mistakes happened, hopefully to, illuminate areas where changes could be made to make the journalism stronger, as I said.
Mm-hmm. To further the conversation between those two groups, the NPR news team and the listeners of NPR. And this is clear. You don't make decisions for the news team. You don't have the authority to do that.
Right. I have I have zero authority.
All right.
Right. I often make suggestions to the newsroom. I guess whether they choose to accept my suggestions or not depends on the clarity of my argument, if you will.
So, right.
I write columns and, where I surface, where I express some of these listener concerns and I, make suggestions and they can do what they want.
Right, right. Let's talk about one opinion piece that you wrote most recently, I think, that did sway the newsroom to change its practice. Now, you pointed out in the column that public trust in media outlets has been taking a drop in recent years, and researchers have, of course, been trying to figure out the causes for that. And you looked into fact reporting versus opinion pieces. What did you look at?
Well, I think one of the issues in terms of media trust in recent years is sort of a corollary issue of news literacy among the listeners and the audience. It seems pretty clear from the research that has been done that a lot of people just don't know the difference anymore between what's a straight news report, what is analysis, what is an opinion piece. And I think that's borne out in some of the emails I get from listeners and readers of NPR. They're not clear sort of when a reporter is expressing an opinion, which is actually very rare. What is the role of analysis? How does that fit into opinions, et cetera? And one of the points that the newsroom and I agree on this, that labeling opinion content in particular is extremely important and is a step towards addressing that confusion. NPR moved, I guess it was last summer, to better label opinion content on the website. So now it all the opinion stories, including my own columns, carry a little blue button that says opinion, and it's pretty clear. That label was not carrying through to social media, and so people were reading the Twitter feed and seeing an opinion headline and thinking maybe it was the opinion of NPR itself, and there was a lot of confusion there.
Mm-hmm. Does NPR have data on opinions expressed on the air in a political way? Are those marked, or is it kept track of so many opinions from conservatives versus liberals and so forth?
NPR actually runs very little what I would call opinion content. That is sort of the equivalent of a newspaper op-ed, someone who comes on the air and says, this is my opinion. There is the segment on the Friday, All Things Considered, which is sort of a conservative versus a liberal,
right,
talking about the week in review.
David Brooks and so forth, EJ Dionne,
mm-hmm,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And others. Jonah Goldberg has been on more recently on Morning Edition. He's a conservative commentator. Occasionally there are NPR staff members themselves who do opinion content. Scott Simon has an opinion piece on his Saturday morning show.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, what I think you're referring to sort of is interviews of conservatives versus liberals. And that's sort of different from opinion content, right? So that's an NPR host who is interviewing someone who clearly has an opinion. We do actually have started keeping track of that in our office because we're getting a lot of questions about that. We just did a 6-month tally of those numbers, and remarkably, while they varied greatly from month to month, the number of conservatives versus liberals who were interviewed, when you looked at it over the 6 months, it was, I think, within one or two people of being even.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Also, mm-hmm, you dealt with, while we're in the political sphere, I know we have a lot of callers who want to hear from Michael and Myrna as well, but on this particular point, you wrote a piece that was partially titled Parsing Political Interviews, and a frustration that you were channeling from many listeners, you write in your column, was that, and I've heard this too, is that you can listen to especially political interviews. They can be frustrating for a host as well as listeners, for sure. Too often it listeners complain it doesn't add to their understanding of the issues being discussed, right?
Right, right, right. So that is a challenge, I think. NPR has increased the number of political interviews that it is doing recently. There's a very logical reason for this, because the news cycle is moving so quickly these days,
mm-hmm,
that it takes time to actually produce a piece to turn it around. And so sometimes if the news changes overnight, the fastest way to sort of get to that news is to do a live interview. That said, you have to be very careful in the people that you book to make sure that these interviews are getting at the heart of the issue, and it's not just allowing someone to spout talking points.
Right, and the dimension of a live interview happens also on NPR's flagship shows as well as on River to River as well, is hosts sometimes are expected to quickly fact-check, know everything in the world, that is really where a politician has a leg up on the host, right?
Right, right. I mean, hosts need to come well prepared,
right,
but it's just not—it's not always possible to know everything that a guest is going to bring up. So NPR has sort of had a challenge at times at dealing with, figuring out how to deal with misinformation when it gets put out in a live interview. They found a couple ways of doing that. Most recently, they've been sort of occasionally leaving time at the end of an interview for a beat reporter to come on and sort of add some more context or fact check if need be.
Mm-hmm.
Most often it's adding context.
Mm-hmm. Michael Leland, I want to turn to you as IPR news director there. From IPR, we don't have any opinion. We don't need to label it on air. Or what is our view of opinion and labeling it?
It's not what we do on the air. If at least not from the news department. I could suppose you could say the closest that we get to opinion is people who, guests you might have on your show, and you will ask them what they think about, something in the news. But as far as in news stories or even interviews that we would do on Morning Edition or on All Things Considered, we're not looking for opinion. We're trying to deal in facts as much as possible.
Mm-hmm. And Myrna, when we look at the IPR's goals in terms of news coverage, the big picture news conversations here, how would you characterize it in your own words? A fair conversation? What else would you add to that?
I would say it's thoughtful and meaningful conversations. We really seek to be a place where it's not sort of screaming and yelling and talking points, but where we're really having a dialogue about the issues that are facing the state. And we hope that our reporting provides a really strong factual base for those conversations. And I would say where we're going is that we're very excited to be thinking statewide. And thinking about adding some reporting from the western side of the state. In fact, we have a reporter starting next week. I'm mm-hmm. very excited
yes.
about, based in Sioux City. And so we're hoping to bring some perspective from some the broader areas in the state as well to the work that we do.
If you've just joined us, Myrna Johnson, IPR Executive Director, along with Michael Leland, IPR News Director. Elizabeth Jensen joins us from NPR in Washington, NPR Ombudsman and Public Editor. Sort of a peek behind the scenes of how we deliver news to you. Also, your chance to talk back to us this hour about how we serve you with the news. 1-866-780-9100 or email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Myrna, Michael, and Elizabeth, plenty of people with input and questions. Let's go right to Steve, first of all, in Marshalltown. Hi, Steve.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. What's your point? Your question.
I've got an editorial question. Thank you. It seems like most media outlets, NPR included, is very cautious with the word lie and uses softer terminology with politicians. And I'm wondering if that's a strategic decision from the newsroom.
Well, I'm sure it is. Elizabeth, can you talk a little bit about that? Because I know in our newsroom and also at NPR's and various programs, whether you say untruth, falsehood, lie, lacking evidence, those matter.
Right. So I can I'm not quite sure what you mean by strategic choice. I will tell you that the policy is that NPR, for the most part, does not use the word lie. It's not that it has never used it in the political context of the past couple years, but the policy is generally to avoid it. And that is because if you look at the definition of lie, it includes intent. It's very hard to get into someone's head and know their intent when they tell something that is not true. You know, you could say that they didn't know. So you really have to sort of prove that they did know and chose to repeat the misinformation anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It's also, I guess if I'm parsing the, so this is not a policy I set, of course, this is a policy that the newsroom sets. If I were to parse the policy, as it was articulated by the previous head of the newsroom, there was an intent on the part of the newsroom also to avoid a word that is inflammatory. So, you know, if you are a newsroom, you want your content to be heard, registered, et cetera, by as wide a group of people as possible, right? As many listeners as possible. Lie is a very inflammatory word. So as long as you are being very clear to correct the misinformation, to say that it is not true, to say that it is false, I think there was probably a strategic strategic on the part of the newsroom, if you will, to say we're going to stay away from a word that's very inflammatory.
Michael from the IPR newsroom, anything to add to Elizabeth's comments there?
No, pretty much the same thing. I mean, the idea that a politician or a corporate spokesperson or somebody is telling the media something that's not true is not new. So, you know, we do our best in any of those cases to try to determine what the truth is. And, you know, if we can, you know, contrast what that person says with what we know to be true, we'll point that out. But to single out a specific thing and say that is a lie, it's generally not something we would do in a news story for the reasons that Elizabeth just said. You know, that gets to intent. And then, you know, the discussion becomes about the word we use rather than the issue we're covering.
Thank you, Steve, in Marshalltown, for a great question. Let's go to Chris. Chris is with us from Des Moines. Hi, Chris. Welcome to the program. What's your question?
Yes, I was wondering, when it comes to race, you guys, you kind of deal with it, but then you really don't. But it's an issue that really does need to be dealt with, since we have a president that is very bigoted, and we have a bunch of Republicans that are very bigoted, too. And so,
Chris, let me just that, hop in here and say, when you say you don't, we don't deal with race, can you just explain that a little bit? I hear plenty of NPR and IPR pieces that do deal with race, for instance.
Well, when it comes to the racism and discrimination that is going on here in Iowa, we don't really deal with it. We really don't. We can try to act like we deal with it, but we really don't. Can you really tell me anywhere here in the state of Iowa where they have really had a true conversation about race?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Chris, in Des Moines.
We have not had that.
Okay, let's get some reaction from, well, Michael, since it was pointed towards Iowa first and foremost, and then Elizabeth. But Michael, first of all, this time, what do you have to say to that criticism of Chris?
You know, as you mentioned, we have covered and continue to cover topics related to race. Whether we get into specific incidents that happen, probably not as often as the caller would like, and it is something that, you know, as we look at things that we want to be covering in the future and be paying attention to, you know, race is certainly one of them, as is poverty and a number of other things in the state. So, you know, in some ways, sure, it's a fair criticism. I wouldn't say we never do it, but, you know, like anything we cover, you know, we could probably do more of it.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, what do you have to say from the NPR level?
Well, from the national perspective, I do hear that NPR deals with this topic quite often. I'd probably say daily. And I'd also note that NPR has an entire unit, reporting unit, called Code Switch, that deals with just race and identity issues. From my perspective, I think the topic is covered pretty widely.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's talk about errors, because those do happen in the news media. We talked about falling mistrust in news media. What NPR recently had some efforts to cut down on errors in its reporting. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Elizabeth?
Sure. The number of errors that are being posted on the NPR corrections list seems to have been growing recently. So the standards and practices editor, Mark Memmott, has put forth a protocol, if you will, to see if they can, if the newsroom can cut that number in half. I think it had gone up to about 100 corrections per month. So they're trying to get that down to about 50 within 4 months, by October.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I've been critical of NPR, and this is an ongoing conversation we're having with the newsroom, about how they handle corrections on the air. So the corrections blog is online. It's on NPR.org. NPR has moved in recent years to really step back from putting on-air corrections. So if they make a mistake in an on-air report, they're only rarely now actually correcting it the next day.
Do you know the reason for that change?
Well, I think part of it is there's a feeling that listeners who heard the initial mistake will not necessarily be the ones who hear the correction, right? Because people they listen at different times. They're not sort of listening necessarily at exactly the same time every day. Very few listeners hear all 2 hours of Morning Edition or of All Things Considered. The newsroom feels that they are very clear about corrections, and I think they are. They're very good about posting the corrections online. My feeling is a little different. I think it's just purely best practices. You make a mistake on the radio, you should correct the mistake on the radio. And then, but there's also another factor. Even if it's not the same people hearing the mistake as hearing the correction, if you talk about corrections on the radio, you are signaling to the listeners that you are a trustworthy news organization, right? Every news organization makes mistakes. You can try as hard as you want, and sometimes things just slip by. Mm-hmm. I just think it's best practices to sort of say, hey, you know what? Occasionally we make mistakes. You can see all of our corrections on the website.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have a couple minutes before we go to break. Let's squeeze in a caller from West Des Moines. Nick is with us. Hi, Nick. Welcome to the program. Not much time. Get right to the point, please. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ben. My question is, I hear a lot about Trump and NATO, Trump and the E2, Trump and Canada. I'd like to know why we're not covering some of the lesser stories, like what's going on in the Cabinet Department. You know, what regulations has Scott Pruitt changed? Betsy DeVos. What's happening with labor? What rules and changes are being changed there?
Right.
I don't see anything. And those are going to affect the everyday man more than anything.
Right.
I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Thanks, Nick. Your concern echoes one that I've heard. I don't know if Elizabeth has. It's just that we are in a singular time under this president where his manner of governing the country and reaching out and talking with other worlds seems to dominate the news on a daily basis. Elizabeth, what do you have to say about Nick's comment there?
Right. Well, we do get that concern quite often, daily, in fact. I guess I would push back a little bit. I think NPR has covered those stories. I do think occasionally they get lost in the other stories, as the caller notes. We have not found many stories that are just completely missing from NPR, because we go back and look when listeners write to us and say, why haven't you covered this or that? It is true. It's a matter of emphasis, if you will. I like to send listeners to NPR.org. You can do a search there that sort of will turn up all the stories. Again, every listener can't hear every 2 hours. But I think it's a fair criticism that, mm-hmm. you know, some stories are maybe not being heard as often as they
right.
should.
We have about a minute before we go to break. I wonder, Elizabeth, off the top of your head, do you think this president, because he has been so different to deal with from a media perspective, from my perspective, and from those at NPR, has he changed practices at NPR because of his different approach to the presidency?
What kind of practices are you thinking
well,
about?
Well, I think we also went this president's relationship with making claims that lack evidence,
mm-hmm.
and
right.
Doing that on a perhaps daily basis,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, that is a challenge for a journalist.
Right, absolutely. Right. And I think the newsroom has had to sort of think very clearly about how to handle those misstatements of fact. You know, you have to make sure that you sort of are very quick to correct anything that is inaccurate. That's absolutely true. They think a lot about that.
Okay. We'll come back after a break. So good to have Elizabeth Jensen with us. She's NPR's news ombudsman and public editor, and serving as a liaison between NPR's newsroom and you, NPR's listeners. We also have with us Michael Leland, IPR news director, and IPR executive director, Myrna Johnson, and we'd like to have you join us. We'll get back to as many listener questions as we can when we come back. Also, I want to ask Michael Leland when we come back, because we're heading up to an election, and also Elizabeth, how we look at guidelines as we approach a midterm election or any election for that matter when we come back. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Dr. Suzanne Stock, board-certified specialist in orthodontics. Dr. Stock is pleased to provide braces and Invisalign for children, teens, and adults in Iowa City and across Southeast Iowa. More online at drssortho.com.
Back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer, giving you this hour a look behind the scenes, so to speak, more like a chance for you to talk back to us this hour about how we're serving you with news and some of our practices. You have questions about how we produce news. We have so many questions from listeners. We want to get back to those as soon as possible and have as many as possible in this next half hour. Elizabeth Jensen is with us, NPR ombudsman and public editor, joining us from NPR in Washington, a liaison with listeners, with the newsroom, between those two, to make the newsroom leaders aware of how listeners feel and help listeners, you, understand why the newsroom makes the decisions it does. And it's really interesting to hear Elizabeth talk about the practices, the rationale behind a lot of the decisions made by NPR. Michael Leland is with us as well, IPR news director, and Myrna Johnson, IPR executive director, with us as well in our Des Moines studio. A little later, I want to ask Myrna to give us a quick snapshot of the funding update of Iowa Public Radio. I know that's high on a list for people listening to this program, and CPB funding. But first of all, let's go back to something I mentioned before we go back to callers. Before the break, election coverage coming up. Michael, let's start with you. What do we think of when we get into, you know, closing in, what is it, between 3 and 4 months before the midterm election? How do we cover election periods differently and interviews with candidates differently? What are the guidelines we follow here at IPR?
Well, when first of all, we're for the most part a statewide organization, so we tend to focus on the bigger races. And this year, that'll be the statewide offices, governor, and so forth. We have a couple of pretty hotly contested congressional races, and we'll continue to focus on those as well. When you get down to state legislative races, we don't give that quite as much coverage because they tend to be much more local, and we only have so many reporters to go around. But we do, sort of keep an eye on the trends that are happening in that area. But we already in the news department are having some conversations about what we want to cover when it comes to, say, the governor's race. What issues do we want to focus on? How do we want to approach them? And then probably later this summer, after Labor Day, when people are paying a lot more attention to the race, we'll start rolling out a lot of that coverage.
Right, right. And just to be sure, Michael, we invite all of our congressional delegation several times a year to interviews with Clay, with myself, with others on this program. And if you don't hear your congressman, that may be because they haven't accepted an invitation. Rod Blum, Congressman Blum, is an example of someone who has not taken us up on an invitation to be interviewed despite repeated invitations.
Right. And before the primary, we did have conversations with all of the Democrats and the two Libertarians who were running in their primaries. And even though she was not on the, did not face an opponent in the primary, we spoke to Governor Reynolds, Clay Masters, who did the interviews, and I talked about the fact that even though she doesn't have an opponent, we thought it was important to hear from the governor because all of these people who want her job are spending a lot of time and airtime criticizing her. And we thought it made sense to direct some of that, some of those comments to her to get her response.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth Jensen, anything to add there as far as political coverage as we enter the final, soon to enter final 3 months before the midterms?
I would just add that in my office, we do get the occasional complaint from listeners that they're not hearing about their specific race or not hearing enough about their specific race. What the newsroom basically tells us is that the national newsroom tries to focus on stories that are of interest for a national-wide audience. So sometimes they don't get down into sort of the nitty-gritty, if you will, of a local race. They try to look at themes and broad concerns that are playing out across the country.
Mm-hmm.
And they do kick off the coverage in earnest post-Labor Day.
Elizabeth Jensen with us, NPR Ombudsman and Public Editor. Michael Leland, IPR News Director. Myrna Johnson, IPR Executive Director. We've got a few minutes. Let's move through as many listener questions as we can here as we come to the second half of our hour here. Laura is with us in Des Moines. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. First of all, I just want to give a real good shout-out to IPR and NPR. I've noticed that you have a lot more women that are maybe even hosting shows. I've noticed On Point's got more women hosting. And I just have noticed that parity. So thank you. And I even noticed one was black. So that's good. But actually, I'm calling today because just recently IPR and the Register commented about the oil spill that was in, I think, central northwestern Iowa. Some trains derailed. And some tar sands oil was leaked. And just in the last day or two, it was stated that the spill was not as bad as was originally reported. And the where that information came from is from the Fox in the Hen House. The company that's doing the cleanup is hired by the company, which is connected to the pipeline. So I would really encourage, and I know you don't have a ton of reporters. I'd like to hear more than just the opinion of the the corporation that's in charge of doing the cleanup, which is connected to the fossil fuel industry. There's a live video of tar sands, and it's pretty bad, actually.
Okay, Laura, thank you very much for the constructive criticism. I don't know if Michael has anything to respond there, or we'll just let it stand, perhaps.
You know, it is one of those things that, as Laura says, it is in a the northwestern corner of the state where we currently don't have a reporter. As of Monday, we will, and that's the sort of thing that we'd be able to give more coverage to. But, you know, yes, we were, you know, quoting, in fact, I read this story when I was filling out on Morning Edition, that a representative of the BNSF Railway said that a smaller number of cars had been compromised than originally thought, therefore, you know, fewer gallons of oil spilled. Still a large spill, still well over 100,000 gallons, but not quite as big as it had been. And obviously still a big cleanup. But, it's one of those things that, you know, it's in a part of the state that's difficult for us to get to, but we hope to be able to get to more of that in the future.
Right. Myrna Johnson, you mentioned because this is perhaps a good time to talk about IPR funding briefly. It's funding from listeners and other sources that allows us to put in a long-needed Western Iowa reporter, right?
Yeah, this has been on my list for years. I'm so excited to finally get there. It's really exciting. I mean, our listeners are so, so important to funding Iowa Public Radio. We just completed our budget for FY19, and we are assuming that about 77% of our funding is going to come from private support this year, membership, underwriting.
That must be a record, I would assume.
I think it probably is. You know, I mean, as long as I've been here, it's certainly a record. So our membership is growing, and our private resources are growing at a time when, you know, government sources are either level or heading downward.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's go back to our phones. Brian with us in Dubuque, 1-866-780-9100, trying to get to as many sort of talk back to us questions as possible, how we serve you with the news. Give us your criticism. We can take it, and perhaps there's an answer, an explanation that will surprise you about something that's perhaps been bothering you that you've heard here. But we love the praise, and we've been getting that this hour as well, too. Brian in Dubuque, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. Thank you for taking my call. I'll try to be brief. I love NPR. I'm a supporter. But one thing that I have noticed is, especially this particular show, is the science journalism. And I know in general, science journalism is pretty terrible. But I've had at least three or four instances where I've had to call in because whoever was organizing who they were having on has left out the mainstream science point of view. And in one instance, it was a product. In another instance, it was alternative medicine. And being someone who really loves you guys and sees very few flaws in what I understand of journalism, I don't know if there was, you know, there's just a process that's being missed with understanding science. I'm lucky enough to where my college gives me the tools to, like, read journals and analyze actual studies and understand what's being said. And for me, it's not a big deal, but for listeners who don't understand that, I feel like there's being pseudoscience promoted in some cases. Okay. And I guess I don't know the process, so how those things are set up, but there's been quite a few instances.
Okay, Brian, thank you very much from Dubuque. If pseudoscience is what you heard, that is, of course, definitely not our aim. We want fact-based science, data-based discussions on this program when we deal with science. Elizabeth Jensen, take it from the NPR News perspective there. We're always looking for evidence for any claims, be they scientific or otherwise, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And I think NPR has been quite good, actually, in its science coverage. At least, you know, I can only speak to the last 3.5 years where I've been here, but I think they take it seriously, and I think they've been very good about not doing sort of he said, you know, one side and the other side. They, you know, especially in terms of, you know, issues of, say, climate change, or I think they are very clear about what the science says and try to keep what I would call pseudoscience off the air.
Mm-hmm. That is our aim. An email from Dan, perhaps a bit related to the last question. Dan writes, I very much appreciate the coverage of IPR and NPR, but I've noticed verbiage in the Harvest Public Media stories seem to match that of the public relations arm of the big ag companies and lobbying groups. One example is referring to confined animal feeding operations as barns. No farmer, writes Dan, does this. If anything, they're hog houses. It's pure industry PR, and I hear it parroted by Harvest Public Media stories. Michael Leland, I don't know if you can specifically speak to this, but what are your thoughts about Dan's concern there?
I think it's a valid concern. I can't think of a specific story where that may have popped up. Harvest Public Media has its own editors who edit stories, and we receive them. But I don't know how often that pops up. But I do talk to the main editor of Harvest on a regular basis, and it's something I can pass along.
All right, let's talk a little bit about language here, Elizabeth, because our language is a living language. We hear that all the time, and it lives on our airwaves, and so we have to have sort of beware of the landmines that appear in the landscape. Elizabeth, what do you have to say? You've been writing about this as well, haven't you, in certain instances?
Indeed, absolutely. We get quite a few listener concerns about language. What I can say is that the newsroom, Mark Memmott, the standards and practices editor, tries to stay on top of the what we call politicized language.
Mm-hmm. As an example, let me just throw in
sure.
Pro-life or anti-abortion. Those would be two different ways of describing something. Undocumented versus illegal when we're in the immigration policy debate, right, Elizabeth?
Right. But there are also things like tax reform, right? So NPR policy is not to call it tax reform. That is one side's view that the tax policy needs to be reformed. The newsroom has been sort of, guided to stay away from the word reform and to talk about, an overhaul of the tax policy, if you will. Entitlements is an issue that I wrote about, whether we should be calling Social Security, Medicaid entitlements or not. Chain migration is another term that has been used by one side and not the other. And the newsroom, for the most part, does try to stay away from those terms. It's hard. So you're interviewing someone who's using those terms.
Mm-hmm.
You're having a conversation. You're thinking live. You're reacting in the moment. And sometimes you do pick up the language that the person sitting across from you is using. But for the most part, the newsroom does try to stay away from those politicized words.
Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, I feel I have to ask you, since we are now in the Me Too era. And as with many organizations and businesses, there were sexual harassment complaints at NPR. Briefly tell us how those were handled.
Sure. I think the best way to say it is they were handled very publicly, which I think was appropriate. So NPR's the head of news left in November amid allegations of harassment. From my perspective, NPR handled the reporting on it. I don't get involved in the internal situation, so management is not my purview, but my purview is the reporting, and I think NPR's reporting was quite transparent. The NPR has a protocol. They have a reporter, David Folkenflik, who covers NPR. He reports to an editor who reports to a deputy managing editor in the newsroom. When a story comes up that involves NPR, they are sort of siloed, if you will, so that they can report on the story. No one else in the newsroom can really know what's being reported
mm-hmm.
or can weigh in. And I thought the reporting was good. I thought, the NPR CEO, Yair Almon, went on All Things Considered and was subjected to a very tough interview. So I think from my perspective, NPR covered itself quite transparently.
Let's go back to the phones. We have about 5 minutes left with Elizabeth Jensen of NPR, the NPR ombudsman and public editor, Michael Leland, a news director at IPR, and Myrna Johnson, IPR executive director. Back to the phones. Dave is joining us from Muscatine. Hi, Dave. Not much time. I'll ask you to be concise, but welcome.
Yeah, thanks, man. During the Obama administration, we noted that on NPR, they were saying once, occasionally President Obama, and most of the time said Mr. Obama. we wrote to NPR asking what was, you know, what this practice was, and they said that in a particular portion that they would say president once, and then they would say Mr. on the rest of the conversation. But we've noticed that during the Trump administration, it is almost universally President Trump, President Trump. I can only recall once hearing Mr. Trump. What changed?
Interesting.
Now, we got a letter back from NPR telling us our practice is to say it President once and then Mr. for all the follow-up in that conversation.
Interesting observation, Dave. Does this square with what you're hearing, Elizabeth?
Well, no, actually, it's the policy is different, so I'm not sure when that letter was set back. So before 2013, NPR did, the policy was to call the president by president in first reference and then Mr. in second reference. I'm looking at my predecessor's column that he wrote on January 17th, 2013, called Bringing the President Down a Notch, NPR Ends Calling Him Mr. So the policy changed at that point. So the policy today is that the president is referred to president for the first time and then just by last name, right. No Mr. in second references. It is possible that hosts, when they're speaking live, do use the word president more often. I can go back and look at that. I haven't heard that, but I can go look at it.
Yeah, Michael Leland, on the statewide basis, when we talk about Senator Grassley, Senator Ernst, it is the same way. Senator Charles Grassley, then after that, you may refer to simply Grassley, right?
Yeah, we may call him the senator, but more likely we will just use his first name, and the same with Joni Ernst as well, just the last name on subsequent references.
Okay, now let's go back to the phones. A couple minutes left. Let's squeeze in Ben from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Ben. Welcome to the program.
Greetings. Greetings all. Yes, I just wanted to say instead of music between like 7 and 5, 5 a.m., 7 p.m., and 5 a.m., I'd like to hear maybe more news-related programming or
okay,
something to that effect.
Okay, Ben in Cedar Rapids, yeah. Our I don't know, Myrna, you can talk about it. We have a great mix of music on three streams and news on three streams. So it's really a quite a cocktail that we hope delights most listeners.
We do. We also have an AM. I'm not quite sure where he said he lived, but he perhaps can catch our AM, which would be news 24/7.
Yeah, 9:10 a.m. in that part of the state.
9:10 a.m. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So that would be a suggestion.
All right. Very good. Let me ask you about... what did I have here, too? Oh, breaking news. So this is all the trend in when you look on the cable news networks and so forth. And you wrote about this, Elizabeth. We don't have much time for it. What makes something breaking news in this day and age? Where is the line? And I know you had a complaint about this. This was in the death of the actress Margot Kidder.
Oh, right.
Or NPR had a complaint. Yeah.
NPR did have it. We had quite a few complaints, actually. So the question is, there are two different issues, breaking news, talking about it on the air, and then breaking news in terms of the alerts that the newsroom sends out digitally to your mobile phone. I think the term is overused. I think breaking news, really, there's so much actual real breaking news these days that, you know, policies are being changed quite a bit. I referred to that earlier in terms of the just the heightened news cycle. So I personally think that breaking news alerts should be saved for actual hard news.
Let me get this in from Beth in Mount Vernon, an email here. Perhaps, Michael, you can answer this or respond to it. We need more reporting on environmental news, especially climate change. For example, Iowa farms contribute a large amount of nitrates into the Mississippi, which is making the dead zone in the Gulf larger and larger. Yet we hear little about this from Iowa public radio reporting when it should be top-tier news. Michael, I can dispute this quite a bit if you don't want to jump in here. We're having next week a whole series on the Mississippi, which will include the dead zone, which we contribute to here with our farming.
Exactly. That'll be all next week. And in fact, one of those programs will originate from Iowa City on Wednesday. But like most topics, we could do more on it. I know Clay Masters has done a number of reports on, you know, water quality in the state, and it's something we do keep an eye on. But like a lot of topics, sure, we could do more.
Right, and great, Beth, it's great to hear that that sort of reporting is appreciated. We keep our eye on that and make sure we do our best to look at those environmental concerns that you're interested in. We've run out of time. I knew we would have so much more to talk about than we had time for. Elizabeth Jensen, thank you for sitting down with us there at NPR in Washington, NPR Ombudsman and Public Editor. Thank you, Elizabeth, for joining us.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Michael Leland, Myrna Johnson, my colleagues, thank you for joining us. Michael, IPR News Director, Myrna Johnson, our Executive Director. Michael,
you're welcome,
Myrna.
Ben. Thanks.
Thanks.
Thank you. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Caitlin Harrop, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Shirley Wong. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. It's a News Buzz edition tomorrow on our program. We hope you'll tune in. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.